My name is Judy Essman, and this is a presentation on children raised in clergy families and the way this discussion has arisen has come through my work in a couple of church-related colleges where I was a psychological counselor for about a total of 10 years. And found that over a course of time, some of my clients were grown children of clergy, and that's pretty likely in a church-related college where many people are from clergy families, so it would be likely that a percentage of my clientele would be those people. What I found as I talked with them over time was I was beginning to hear similar comments about them, from them about their struggles. Some related to the family that they grew up in. And the more that I saw those patterns, the more I was interested in that and decided to do some checking with older adult children of clergy and to see if that was true for them. And as time has gone on, I found that there are some similarities. And I wanted to talk about that tonight, and I realized that as I thought about talking about it, I feel very, I don't know if humble is the word, or a little out of my element, I guess, because I'm talking about people, other people, talking about other families. I'm not a child of a clergy person. And I feel that in some ways I'm going into territory that I can't claim as my own. And it makes me want to be cautious about that and want to caution you that what I am saying are purely my observations. And I would be very interested as I present some of those to hear your understanding or points of view or examples to contribute to the discussion. But still, I said to myself, well, why talk about it at all? So what? So you're interested, you know? And I realized I had two reasons for talking about this at all. And one is that I did find that the more I shared with people who grew up in clergy families what I was hearing from other children of clergy, the more reassured, I guess, I saw those people become about who they were and what their families were like. My hope is that the more that people who are from like backgrounds share about their backgrounds, the more they come to respect themselves, where they've come from, and also learn acceptance and forgiveness and letting go. So I guess saying some of this can work in that direction. And the second reason is that some of the struggles that I heard adult children of clergy talk about seem to me coming from or originating from the complicated role that the clergy person lives out and the societal expectations that all of us carry about clergy and their families. And I see society as being somewhat responsible to think through how they want to behave toward clergy and their families and maybe reevaluate some of that. So I guess I'm speaking on behalf of society and congregations and parish members. I think it behooves us to do a little thinking about it. So that's why I'm talking about it. I'm going to talk about two different things. I'm going to talk about what I saw as the gifts and rewards that come out of growing up in a clergy family that I heard people talk about, and I'm also going to talk about the struggles that I heard those people talk about. So there'll be two different things. Most of the people that I have talked with have had fathers as the clergy person. They're not of the generation yet where there are women who are in the clergy and they're for their mothers. So most, everyone, 100% of the people I've ever talked to have had fathers as the clergy person. Most of the people I talked with grew up in parishes or churches connected to congregations, some rural and some urban, some suburban. A few of those people had mothers who also worked outside the home in other activities, but there was only a few. And what I also found was that some of the observations that I'll be telling you about, I also heard from children of missionaries, that it's not identical, but some of the same patterns have held true there. They have some additional things, particularly schooling, boarding school issues. Everything that I would say will be general observations on my part. When I talk, it may trigger in something in you that, oh yeah, I know somebody just like that, or who's this way or that way. And what I'm trying to do is break down stereotypes, not create them. So, like I'm saying, they're general observations, and everyone is unique, and you need to keep remembering that. I also won't be discussing any single person, even though some example may sound familiar. It will be no one you know, because all my examples will be sort of a blend of what I've heard. Okay. One other question I asked myself was, why don't I also have a session tomorrow night on children of engineers or children of physicians or children of business people, or why do this one? And part of it is the unique audience that you are, people who are church people, and many of you are children of clergy, so that, I guess that's one of the reasons. And the other is that I think in our society we have a special little niche that we give to the clergy that's a little different than we do to physicians and than we do to teachers, even though we ascribe a lot of virtues to those people. I think we add a little extra element for the clergy, and that is that they were called by God to do what they're doing, to do God's work. And a physician could argue, I'm sure, of being called by God and doing God's work. But I think we are more inclined to think of the clergy in that category more often than we are of any other profession. And because of that, I think we can create some particular patterns. And that you'll see that, I guess, as I talk. Anyway, are you ready for me to talk? 5-minute disclaimer there. And like I said, I would appreciate hearing your comments. In people talking about their families, I noticed some special gifts that these people either had because I just saw them having them, or them actually saying, I'm glad I had this growing up. And I'm going to tell you about three or four of them that seemed fairly common among children who grew up in clergy families. And one was that they grew up not only in their family, but they grew up in a congregation or a group or a community who knew them, knew their names, sought them out, invited them to do things, gave them gifts, attended to them, paid special attention to them. And what I found was that those people have learned some wonderful social skills. They can talk with people of all different ages. They have poise in social situations often. They're good people to be in a group with because they've grown up having to interact with so many others. And I think that's a real gift. They've often had the opportunity to meet very interesting people. They've been around a lot of interesting people and ideas, and that's not for everyone, but many of the children that I've talked to have had opportunities to talk with politicians and theologians and professors and other public figures because of the interactions of their parents, have been accustomed to thinking through some interesting ideas. There's also a trend I've noticed of being an appreciator of the arts, music and art and dance, and I'm not sure what the connection is there, but I've heard that very frequently. And then the opportunity to travel, to go to different places, to go on sabbaticals, to go when dad goes to speak or whatnot, chance to leave where you are and see something new. And another gift is, even though most of the people that I've talked to moved while they were growing up because there was a change in parish, they had the advantage of falling back into a new community and having that security there again. It would be like going from one group that was bidding you goodbye to another group that's opening their arms and welcoming you in, and that there's a sense of security about that in the midst of change. A rarer comment that I heard, I thought I would hear it a lot more, but as I think it through, I realize that of course I wouldn't hear this as often, but a few people have said what a gift it was to live, to see theology lived out every day, to see the application of the gospel in everyday life, and a real appreciation of that because of their parents and how their parents did that. I didn't hear that often. I thought I'd hear that a lot, but I did hear that once in a while. So that's what I see to be some of the special gifts of growing up in a clergy family. You have any comments about that or additions? Speculations? Okay. Does anybody here know anyone who grew up in a clergy family? Before I go on, who's my audience here? How many of us do not know anyone who's grown up in a clergy family? Okay. Good. Are some of you distantly or not related to clergy? How many of us are related to clergy, distantly or closely? Uncle, grandfather, father, mother, whatever. Okay, about a fourth of us. All right. So maybe we have some familiarity. Maybe we went to school with people who were children of clergy, dated them. Okay, I'm just trying to ground us a little bit in who we're talking about here. I noticed that there were some struggles that these people held in common, and of course by being a counselor, that's a lot what I hear, as I hear the struggle side of life, and so it may be skewed a little bit because of that observation on my part. But one sort of global or universal struggle that I heard from people who grew up in clergy families was a confusion of the clergy parent with God. A difficulty in learning to separate the parent from God. Now we struggle with that as a society, the sense that the clergy are sort of one step higher than we are, little bit closer to God, because they speak the word of God, they try to live that out for us. I see Susan smiling back there. But we do that. We assume that they've been called and are doing divine work, and so they're one step higher. Well, as children growing up, we all tend to do some idolizing of our parents. When a society is also doing that, It sometimes is difficult to know dad as human or dad as ordinary or dad as normal kind of thing. So some of the tendency there then is to see the father as perfect. If I could only be like my dad, then I'd be okay. Or dad is really wonderful. I can't think of anything that dad's ever done wrong. Or dad is, I'll try to emulate him if I can. That can also work to instill a fear about God, about father, about dad, that he has such power, such ability to judge us, to criticize us, to know us, like we assume God does. Can instill a sense of guilt that if I'm not perfect like my dad, then I'm falling short. Those are understandable kinds of things, I think. But there is that confusion of where do I put dad? Is he here? Is he up here a little bit? Or where is he? Because we as society have ordained some Christians to be officials of the community, that is, pastors, we expect those people to keep community in their minds. That's what they're about, to keep the Christian community together. And so they live a life that's more public than many of the rest of us Christians do, because we individually struggle with our faith. They have to struggle with the body, the corporate body. They live a public life. And like I said, there's some real advantage to that for children growing up, but there's also some real difficulties with that. Because they're in the public eye a lot of the time, there's often roles that are expected to be played by the children. One of those is to be very good, to be a good person, nice, kind, generous, no moods. Perfect, kind of like dad. And I think that can create some problems when you feel angry, when you want to try something that's different, when you feel crummy about yourself. That's real difficult to act, to live out when the rest of the world is looking at you expecting you to be good. I remember the first time I saw my ninth grade home economics teacher drinking a beer and smoking a cigarette on the back of a boat that she just happened to be on, and so was my family. I couldn't believe that she would do that. This is a teacher who has their own set of things. Well, imagine a clergy person doing that, and then imagine a clergy teenager doing that. No. So you can see that kind of struggle. What that does, all this kind of combined, I guess I'm talking about us as society and so on. What all this does is it creates a kind of pressure on people who live in clergy families. You know, and there's all those gifts, but there's all those pressures. And one thing that we say here, we kind of kid around at Holden and other places, we call children of clergy PKs, you know, preacher's kids. And I think I try to avoid that, saying PKs, I guess, because I'm trying to avoid the stereotypic demands or expectations that we lay on people who are children of clergy. And you know that in your high school, when you thought of PKs, you thought of them as real, real good or real, real rebels. They often fell into those kind of categories. If they didn't, there was something kind of wrong with them. Who were they? You know, if they were mediocre or sort of bland, it didn't quite fit. I would suggest that we don't use that term. I know that children of clergy sometimes call each other that, and if that's a way to be kindred with each other, I think that can be useful. But certainly, they're influenced by what other people think of them. Two things I saw in the clients who came to me was either a real struggling for a success or achievement on the part of the clergy person, child, of trying to get good grades, to use all their talents all the time, be ready to perform at the drop of a hat. You know, will you please play the organ next Sunday when you come home during spring break or something like that. Always ready, always look attractive, and so on. And that's a lot of pressure. And for the women, I often found them also struggling with eating disorders. Not that they're the only people that have eating disorders, but I think that there's some struggle around trying to get some control over your life when all the rest of the world is trying to control you and push you down this one tunnel. I think there's I also saw the opposite. The sense that if I can't be good, I'm going to be really bad. You know, I'm going to show you that I'm not this. I'm this over here. And I think the rebelling kind of thing is real, and it's certainly a way to cope. It can be done publicly, that is for all the world to see, including the parents, or behind the scenes, so that the parents are the ones who don't know. And that is the typical or ordinary experimenting that adolescents and young adults do with different kinds of behavior that can kind of get amplified in a clergy person. So some of the people I saw then were struggling with drinking, alcohol abuse or sexual acting out. And what I heard from these people, and you know, I guess what I'm talking about is 18 to 22 year old people. The reason they were coming to see me was finally saying, I don't know who I am. Where am I in all this? Is this really what I want to do? Is this really me? Do I really want to be a pastor? Do I really want to, I can never relax. I always have to get top grades, or they always expect me to party, and I don't want to go next week, but they expect me to be there. And how do I break that? Who am I? Those are typical struggles, but I think society doesn't help that by how we view children of clergy. So that's kind of on the outside, I guess, for those of us who are looking in. What I heard from the inside, within the family structure, was some things that I didn't know, but were real helpful in understanding kind of what was going on. Those of you who have had parents who are also in public roles, particularly in serving roles, probably can identify with this one. A common complaint, I'm not sure, no, it's not 100%, but a very high percentage of people that I talked to have complained that they don't have enough time with their father, that he was so busy serving the community that he wasn't there for me. Also, the double edge to that of people coming up and saying, your father is so good, he's so helpful, he's done so much for us, he's such a kind man, he's so generous. And at home, he comes home and he goes to bed, or he's in his study, or he's tired, or he's angry, and the child doesn't see that kind, generous, giving person that the community sees. And that contrast is hard to take, it's hard to hear that. I think the thing I heard next most common to that complaint was a concern over mother. there seemed to be a lot of ambivalence about the role that mother played in relationship to the father clergy person. Either that all mother really did was lived to work with dad, to help him out, to facilitate him, and a deprivation of mother too, not only of father. But what I heard more frequently was a struggle about, and this isn't surprising at all given the changing roles that women are experiencing right now, of a resentment of the mother for not supporting the clergy father as well as she should have. Especially if she wanted to go off to work, especially if she didn't agree with his theology, especially if she didn't like the congregation, if she wanted to go somewhere else. Those kinds of things that the children really felt torn about, that especially if they thought the father was a little better or higher or closer to God. How can mother act like this? A real anger at her for doing that, or a confusion. Why would she want to do this? Why doesn't she support him? Sometimes the child stepping in and fulfilling that role. Or the other thing I heard, was that something's wrong with mother. She's crazy. And I guess what I want to say about that is I heard that much more often than I expected to. I heard of mothers suffering bouts of severe depression, being hospitalized for nervous breakdowns, drinking, and abuse of other drugs, namely pills, suicide attempts, and so on, that were pretty much covered over, were secret, and that was something that the community didn't know, but the family had to deal with, and most often it was dealt with just quietly. Don't tell about this. I guess I was surprised. I feel naive about that, I guess. And I'm not saying that that's true of every clergy spouse at all, but I'm saying that I heard that more often than seemed chance, I guess. So that's out there for you. The other thing I noticed was, particularly among teenage males, was a tendency of self-destructive behavior. Car accidents, suicide attempts, successful car accidents. That was surprising to me, too. And I'm not saying that that's true of everyone, of course, but it seems like the statistics in my sample were higher than I thought. And the last comment I want to make about, and I don't know if this is a struggle or if this is just a normal thing for people growing up, but what I saw was, I asked to learn of clergy if they felt like they were theologically well-educated by growing up in a clergy family. And what I heard was, no, not particularly. That I developed my own theology as I grew. And it's probably, most likely, different than the parents' theology. That the understanding is different. And that doesn't surprise me. They're different people. They grew up in different times and all of that. So of course the theology is different. But for me that was kind of a surprise and broke the stereotype for me of, well, he or she must think like her dad or his dad. Well, no, that doesn't seem to be often the case. Well, that's the information I have. and it's just mine, and I guess I would feel uncomfortable just leaving it that. I would like to hear your comments about what I've said, your observations, to I don't know, to put a little more reality onto it or whatever. So did it make what I said make you think of anything or?
What do you mean by successful car accidents?
Oh, I meant suicide. But that's not a socially appropriate way, but it's a way that would fit someone who's trying to be kind.
I wonder, you talk about the statistics of the spouse, the mother having troubles being alcoholic or abusive or whatever. If those statistics are actually higher with the people you talk with in counseling, if those people are
sure.
maybe in counseling because of, if you took a wider cross-section of people who aren't in counseling.
Yeah, I guess what I'm saying is that everyone I talked to was in counseling.
Yeah.
Anyway, so
yeah.
When I heard that more often from people from that kind of family, then it sort of perked me up a little more to ask questions a little bit more about that. And I'm not, once again, I'm not saying that that's how it has to be or that it's universally true. I guess that's why I feel so cautious about what I'm saying.
I experienced a lot of conflict about, growing up, learning the ideals of Christianity, and hearing the word of God coming from my father from the pulpit, but really realizing the fallibility of my father, that making it real difficult to just kind of take what he was saying, and also then and in a way having an absence of a pastor, that I did not have a pastor because I had my father, and those two roles did not mesh very well in my situation.
Absolutely.
Because I wasn't able to have the same misconceptions about a pastor that the rest of society was, because,
you don't have the myth, or
right.
You have the myth, but you have the reality.
It wasn't this wonderful person you could go to talk to about this or that. It was bad.
True.
Yeah, I remember going in for confirmation before we get confirmed. Everyone in the class was going to talk with the pastor. With your parents, and that was mom and dad, but it was in the office. here I was, just like everyone else, I guess, supposed to be able to answer these questions and things. And that, for some reason, I think it was, really, not as much understanding as I was supposed to have, in that way, I think, too. But it almost seemed like we could kind of fudge over that because I'm supposed to know that or something.
Between your pores.
Yeah. Or it'd be really embarrassing if I didn't know that. For them.
Yeah, to be the best in the confirmation class is a real pressure.
Yeah, if no one else is going to talk, Ralph will answer.
I noticed an ambivalence in a niece of mine whose father is a pastor, in that I think I can say fairly certainly that she's proud of him,
mm-hmm.
but she won't let anyone at school know what her father does.
Mm-hmm.
And is hesitant to have, she's in junior high now, this wasn't true in elementary school, but junior high. She doesn't want people to come home with her because they might find out that her father was a pastor.
Mm-hmm. Because of what they'll then think about her.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, yeah.
The expectation.
I don't know that she could.
Yeah, but I would guess that's why that's working.
I was just going to say, I felt that I didn't want people in Rochester to know that my father was a pastor. And in 10th grade, my math teacher went to our church. And he came in and he said, I had done something for Youth Sunday. I'd been a good pastor's daughter and done the sermon, I think. And he said, yes, there is a VK, but I'm not going to tell you what that means because that would embarrass her too much. And I'm like, oh. And somebody in the class knew what it was. But I just remember thinking that was just the worst thing to be labeled, and I did not want anybody to know.
Some people at Luther tried to form a support group, and instead of just get off the phone, they're going to call it the PK Club. Never get off the ground anymore.
That would be a good idea, though. So
is it different for children who are raised in the city than in a small town in terms of their anonymity? And do they talk, are there different stories, or do they experience basically the same?
Well, my sample was too small to be able to say for sure, except that I sensed that people who had grown up in an urban area had some chances for escape. They could just go somewhere and not be known for who they were, including the spouses, I think, could feel that anonymity. In the rural areas, more what I found, but I found this true about rural areas, period, was that there's the people from rural areas who came for counseling had quite it was messier. Things were just tougher. And I think it's lack of resources and that feeling real closed in and that necessity for secrecy that really breeds an isolation and a real skewed way of looking at something.
I think also, you know, if your dad is doing preaching the word of God, it's there aren't too many vocations you can choose that are that
good
enough. Live up to that. You know. And especially if if you have conflicts with the type of with mainstream Christianity, you know, what's it leave you, you know, because there's just not a job.
Yeah. And that's that struggle that I was saying about before. Who am I in the midst of all of this? And I think that one thing I found was that there are a lot of feelings that children of clergy can carry. Not everyone does, but some can carry strong feelings of resentment, disappointment, anger, hurt. And that those feelings, if they can be expressed and shared, often kind of open the doors and can breathe a little more and say, you know, I'm okay, I know who I am, and who I am is fine. Just like Dad is fine and Mom is fine, so am I. We're just different. But that takes some courage, I think, because of the connection with God, the connection with the divine. Makes it pretty powerful. I just wanted to say one thing that you said. I think the thing about not having a pastor is really also true for spouses, that the wife of a clergyman often doesn't feel like she has a pastor to go to. I think that can feel limiting.
This theory that clergy families should, the family should go to another church.
Mm-hmm.
They ought to belong to another congregation so that they can be anonymous and just be the person. But I don't think that works well. That would alleviate, that would be the help the
issue of having a pastor, mm-hmm. having somebody to talk to
that would be separate from mm-hmm.
the
family. Yeah. Maggie, did you? Well, it just occurred to me that if they have those kind of troubles with their father, what in the world will happen to Melanie and Ron's little baby? Her mother's a pastor, her father's a pastor, and where's she going?
That was her pastor.
Oh,
my pastor, Claire, and we have a man and a woman, and they share the pulpit.
Mm-hmm.
And they're expecting their first child. So this little girl isn't going to have a mama at home, per se, or a daddy that goes to work, because her mama's going to go to work at the same place her daddy's going, and I think it would be very confusing. There aren't enough men and women pastor teams for that little girl to say to somebody, is your mom and daddy a pastor? Mine is. You know, I mean, she's really going to be out there mm-hmm. in the world alone.
Mm-hmm. Because she has parents who are so going into a new frontier that mm-hmm. society isn't really? Used to yet.
And in a small town
mm-hmm.
with a lot of old-fashioned people.
She might also have a break, though, about that, and that is that they might be a little more realistic then about the role. I'm thinking that things are changing now. You know, when I think about the people I know who are going into the seminary now, and then we'll have children, I have a sense that, and I even have a sense of that about society, that we're demystifying the role a little bit, that there's a real push in congregations to divide up the many job duties of the pastor among the laity, mm-hmm. and to have lay workers, and that they're not everything to everybody. You know, and I think that the more we do that, and so that the pastor can get on with reminding us about the being the community of God, the better it's going to be for everybody. So I would suspect that times are changing. I might, you know, that's my hope anyway. So this child might have a break that way.
I wondered if there's anything different than what you mentioned associated with children of missionaries. Can you spend time in boarding schools?
Yeah, that's the only difference that I'm sure there are other differences, but that's the one. Mm-hmm. Then they're coming back to the other culture, to the U.S., that kind of shift, and often that happens around college, when they go to college in the U.S., getting used to another culture. But what I just heard some quite difficult stories about boarding schools, where children left their families young, 8 or 12 years old, and went to boarding schools. We often religious run boarding schools that were quite abusive, and that there was no way to tell anybody about that. Now I don't know if that's true anymore, but I that's what I was hearing.
That boarding school thing that foster rich people's children.
Yeah, that's real popular.
They're shoved away because the parents don't want them.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is just because of circumstance.
Mm-hmm. But the little girl that Maggie talks about, they end up being like little Claire mm-hmm. in the congregation. Everybody, she don't think everybody needs to know. They don't think they're early. Mm-hmm. Or boy, whichever. Mm-hmm. If you think about it for yourself, do you carry some particular expectations around your pastor or the pastors that you know, you want them to behave in a certain way, or you hold them in certain esteem that perhaps leads you to be disappointed or too demanding, or, you know, all those things that I think we tend to do with public figures, particularly clergy. I mean, for instance, I expect, you know, any clergy person I know to just knock me over every Sunday with a sermon. I mean, I just want to be on the floor when they're finished. And I don't think that has ever happened. You know, I don't know it's never happened. But that's the kind of expectation, is, you know, that you really, that they're coming down from the mountain or something is what I expect. So, I mean, that's, I can talk to myself about that. But I just know that that's a little piece that I carry, and I know better. I mean, I thought it through a little bit.
I'm going to try a little
shock. Right. But I just confess that as a way to remind us maybe of those things that we carry, responsibilities we place. I have a little quote. I looked in our library for books about pastors and clergy children and families and spouses, and we have a very peculiar selection, and I don't know if I would recommend any of them. Really. But I thought that this one person, Lucille Lavender, who is an opera singer and married to a pastor, wrote in her preface something I just think is true. I think it's true about how we can't, how bad we can be in our visions of what clergy are like. She says, she talks about ministers. Her husband is a Baptist minister, I guess. Ministers are people too, I think, she says. Ministers are made very special by their maker, who issues them their special call. They have outstanding talents in every conceivable field. Administration, writing, public speaking, diplomacy, psychology, economics, medicine, building maintenance, teaching, teaching, counseling, comforting, conciliating, coordinating, and creating. Ministers have anatomical characteristics that the rest of us don't have. They are built not to wear out as easily as normal humans. They are more resistant to sleep and relaxation, so they can work a 16-hour day, 7 days a week. If they're waking in the middle of the night by the telephone, they can't get back to sleep, they go to work. There is something unusual about their flesh, too. Their skin is extra thick and tough, so they can be roasted for dinner with a minimum of discomfort. And this helps them withstand possessive, particular, and peeved people. Under this thick skin is a special cushion of insulation that keeps them immune to feelings that other people have, like never getting angry, despondent, disgusted, or discouraged. It also insulates them against needing love, acceptance, praise, encouragement, or raises in salary. Ministers are all-knowing, all-wise, all-comforting, all-controlled, all-put-together, and always there. Then she says, do you know any ministers like that? She says, I don't. And I live with one. And then she writes about what that's like for her as a spouse. But I think we can slip and do all of those things sometimes. Well, anyway.
Yeah. I have a different kind of question.
Okay.
What have you run across people that have part-time jobs as being a pastor and something else?
No.
I was wondering if that.
Do you know somebody like that?
Yeah. Is it helpful or important for clergy kids to know other clergy kids?
I think it is.
We had our two nephews and niece here last summer, and it was real intriguing for them to find out, you know, as what, 9 through 15 year olds, they were a range in age, to find out who in the staff were children of pastors. You know, in the way that that age would look up to the volunteer staff here, and then they were, mm-hmm. It was kind of even more special mm-hmm. for them to find out which of those people mm-hmm. And I thought it, and in some ways it was good because then they saw them not as better or special, but I think they saw them that they could be an okay person who gets along with everybody and fits mm-hmm. into groups and still have been a kid of the past.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that was true.
Did you work with the pastor's
fathers? No. I think it would be wonderful to hear somebody do a session on what it's like to be the spouse of a pastor, and also what it's like to be a pastor and be a father and a neighbor and a husband and whatever, what that feels like.
One thing also, yeah. I think with the secularization of society in general, you know, basically, the people on our block kind of looked at my dad kind of like, well, what's he doing this for, you know? I mean, most of them didn't go to church. Most of them, you know, weren't active Christians. And it was kind of like, you know, and those were my friends. And they didn't go to church, my friends, a lot of them, you know. My friends from church did, but, and it was kind of, I know that it was sometimes hard for me to accept what he did in some ways, because I did want to be like my friend.
Seems so peculiar.
Mm-hmm. That, well, you know, especially if I would have questions about Christianity, it'd be this conflict of realizing he was doing what he felt was a call of God, and then on the other hand, wondering, are you just spending your whole life doing this? Well, what if, you know, what if this is not it? You know, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Another thing I noticed too, at least in our family, is that my father doesn't have any close friends. You know, he's too busy doing things in the congregation, and New Year's Eve, no one's going to invite the pastor over for a New Year's Eve party. That was always kind of, my mother felt kind of bad in cases like that. She felt there was no socialization. I think everybody had the idea that my father doesn't drink, my father doesn't swear, my father doesn't do anything, so there'd be no fun at a party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not only would he be no fun, but if, I mean, that's our thought, but that if we run into him and we find out that he's a pastor, we're going to feel like our imperfections jump out about this far. So it's not only that he's a wet blanket, it makes us feel like we're worse or something. Ralph, did you want to say something?
Well, I just have all kinds of things that I'm saying. One is what Ralph was saying before about, you know, the expectation that he is a pastor, what are you going to do in a job worthy of you would have to be at least a ministry. And you saying, I think times are changing. I think they are too. My father was a clergy child also, and his dad, they had five kids, three sons became ministers and two daughters married ministers. And really, I think my dad always had the feeling that there was no profession worthy of Clarence Carlson's sons other than the ministry. And because of that, many times in his life he always thought about, should I be doing this? You know, maybe I should have been something else. You know, lest anyone know that their pastor has second thoughts about a call or something. Yeah. And because of that, you know, your question on expectations, I think I lost all those expectations of the pastor. I tend to see pastors as much more human than I suppose most people do. In fact, I see through all kinds of those other feelings, I guess. And another thought was really our expectations of clergy. I think my dad died of a heart attack 3-4 years back, and I think a majority of the reason for it was the incredible stress and the fact that he couldn't escape that. Whenever someone would see him, you know, like you say, sir, close friends. He had a lot of close friends in terms of, you know, whenever they'd get together with him or just see him in passing, they'd drop their problems on him. You know, it was always in that kind of counselor position where if you just had a couple minutes to spare, pastor, could you listen to what's going on? And he'd dump one more. He was always there to listen, but you couldn't get away from him. You'd go and drink coffee downtown on the golf course, and you get it for 18 holes, you'd hear about the guy's problems. If anything, you encourage normal socialization things with clergy, but a basic idea that we don't do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and maybe to remind ourselves why we ordain certain Christians to do what they do. Put that in perspective again. What that means. What are we asking there? What are we calling there? We're all called. What are we calling? Mm-hmm.
as a congregation, that person to do and be.
I found that true when I was in the seminary too. I mean, that there's a real stigma attached to that society, and that just socially, it's like it's difficult. People couldn't handle it. I mean, I would be at a party and people would walk away from me once they found out I was in seminary. So I, you know, like that was really the first experience I had had of being sort of ostracized because of something. I mean, I'm pretty, you know, mainstream. But I think that's true. I mean, that whatever we expect of pastors is something other than what we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In my experience, too, is really strange in that is that coming into it late, you know, having had life, at least living it in somewhat a free manner for myself, is the surprise of being in the ordained ministry and putting those expectations on myself all of a sudden. So that I was careful, you know, not embarrassed to go into the liquor store to buy wine for communion, but there are the people, you know, that I would be seeing in there. When all the years prior to that, I was in liquor stores drinking, not a lot, but you know, that it was okay if I wanted to go in, I could. And nobody ever said, well, you shouldn't be in here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure whether that was my expectation or the people in the community, you know, or whether I would go to a New Year's Eve party if I were invited. Because I wouldn't want to be, you know, I mean, that's a real struggle. And I was real surprised that was happening to me. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that I all of a sudden assumed some of those things when I certainly don't feel any different about myself now than I did before I was ordained. Mm-hmm. But I started to play the role.
Yeah.
What?
Well, and when you think of that's yeah. the level of expectation we have when what we really want is sort of the, you know, how do we live as Jesus lived? Let's figure this out as a group and do this and, you know, help us and guide us. And instead we're talking about whether or not we can go to a party. I mean, but that's where a lot of the pain is, I think. What were you going to say, Sam?
I was just going to say one of my roommates in college was really, really mad at her dad for years because he became a pastor when she was in junior high at some point. And she used to go on and on and on about how it stifled their lives, you know, that she had a normal life before. And then all of a sudden, she and her dad and everyone else put all kinds of stipulations on their lives.
Yeah, and then how will she look at pastors after that? Where mm-hmm. will she go to? Or who will she use to?
She really changed her mm-hmm. life in
4 years. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that anger is not uncommon.
Well, the whole idea, if you think of your father as God, and when your father tells you, well, we're moving because I've got a call, you know, this call meaning it's from God. And it's kind of hard to say, oh, I'm pissed, I don't want to move.
God didn't call me.
I disagree with that.
That. I think that's sort of part of the anger with me came in. I felt helpless. And when you were reading what the woman had written in the preface of that book, I'm sitting there, yeah, agreeing to everything, except for I would add in the last part, except in the home. Because it said, you know, he is
giving
to
all
everyone. And then I would just add, except in the home. Mm-hmm. Because so much is expected of him elsewhere. And it's hard to do anything when he goes up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's 9 o'clock. I appreciate you coming and
thank you.
I would recommend one little book. No, and I haven't read it all even, so I don't know if I could. I just can recommend the one little part in the back where he kind of talks about what a pastor is, a priest and a pastor in community. And it's William Willimon, Worship as Pastoral Care. It's a book we have in the bookstore and in the library. And I don't know whether the rest of the book is okay or not, but I liked a few of the things he said about putting a pastor in the community as a part of the helper with that.